You're listening to Siren Radio, and it's time for another edition of Cultural Connections. And in our latest programme, we'll be featuring not one, but two wonderful professors, one of whom has a deep connection with science, technology, engineering and mathematics from that point of view, and the history of medicine as well. We've also got a fabulous senior teaching soul as well, and collectively, we're going to be addressing a whole range of topics, including the STEM agenda, and indeed strategies for the challenges facing the humanities in the 21st century. In fact, so much to pack into the programme. Let's move straight away into the introductions and let's turn to our senior lecturer to start off with. That's Doina Carter. Doina, welcome to your first edition of Cultural Connections. Just so we've actually got our descriptor right here, you're part of the Lincoln School of Architecture. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Excellent. And you're also, of course, School Director of Teaching and Learning. So clearly education is very close to your heart.
Indeed. I qualified as an architect in Romania, and then I moved to England, where I worked for quite a while in practice. So there are a few buildings I designed, and they even got built. As I was working in one of the practices, one of our students asked me if I would like, I was mentoring him at the time, and he said, would you like to be a visiting tutor for our university? And that's how my education, my second career, sort of kick-started.
It's a portfolio, it's a whole range of things. We move from your own very significant role within architecture to the head of School of Humanities and Heritage, of course, is the wonderful Professor Amy Livingston. How are you, Amy?
I'm very well, thank you.
Excellent. Keeping cultural going, we've got Romania, obviously, from your own point of view. It's mostly North America that actually, the Associate Dean of the Honors College at Bale State University in Muncie, Indiana.
I was the Associate Dean of at Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana, in the Honors College.
There we are.
Actually, Bale sounds a little bit better.
Well, I was thinking, I kind of gave it a deliberate sort of pronunciation twist on that,
yes,
just in case you were.
Yes, well, you know, we in the Midwest, we like our twang, so.
Now, you also have an expertise in medieval history.
Indeed,
so
yes.
So clearly from that point, Lincoln, pretty much destiny was bringing you here, I presume.
Well, I've often referred to Lincoln as my own medieval wonderland, since it has just about anything a medievalist could want. Although my own area of expertise is actually France, but being able to live in a town with a cathedral and a castle, and of course, the cathedral and castle were started by William the Conqueror, who I do believe came from the other side of the English Channel. So there is certainly a French or at least a Norman connection there.
It's a tenuous link, but nevertheless, it is one which is worth making from that point of view. And from there, of course, we move to someone who has mentioned that the introduction is basically connected with STEM, science, technology, engineering and mathematics, because actually shares in common with myself a connection with King's College. It's where I did my chemistry and biology degree back in the day. It's the Pro Vice Chancellor and Head of the College of Arts, Professor Abigail Woods. How are you, Abigail?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. And indeed, just setting that scene there, because you're head of the College of Arts, but you do have a key connection with the history of science, technology and medicine.
Yes, I've sort of made a very roundabout route in my career because I started off being a vet. And when that didn't sort of quite turn out to be the wonderful career I thought it was going to be, I went back to university and thought, well, I'll do history of science. It's sort of similar. And then, you know, from history of science, I then moved to history, and from history, I've moved across the arts. So yeah, from veterinary medicine to the College of Arts is, bit of a journey.
I'm just intrigued because obviously Liz Mossop has a veterinary background. We clearly have a key agricultural link with respect to Rye's Home and, of course, the Lincolnshire Agricultural Society. Is this a sort of connection that clearly, if it's not medieval history, you need to have a veterinary background for Lincoln?
Well, you know, the fact that my research has been on the history of farmed livestock, on the history of animal health, I mean, you know, with Lincoln being so big in the agricultural area, and also, you know, developing its own medical school, and, you know, there are all sorts of, like Amy, there are all sorts of intellectual connections that brought me to Lincoln as well as the institution itself.
Let's move to our first choice of music. And Doina, you have the joy of actually going down the line of Yusa Endor, not connected with Romania as such, but why have you actually elected for this as your first piece of music?
Well, I think that we all mentioned how difficult it was to choose just three pieces. And I thought that I'll do exactly what I tell our students to do, bring some meaning into what we do. So the three choices represent three moments of my life. And this was a time when I was in London, and it was London was this amazing metropolis which attracted talent and the best shows in town. And this was one of the first things I saw, with Yusen Dur being an absolutely amazing showman. And what was memorable about this experience was that it was at the Royal Festival Hall, so everybody was very proper, very sitting down and listening, which they did for about half of a song, after which everybody stood up and started dancing in the same manner as the Yusen Dur and his amazingly talented band.
Avril, le choc de 2015.
Say that I was expecting Professor Abigail Woods to be dancing around already with another note, but no, she's stayed fixed in the same position, as indeed has Professor Amy Livingstone. Sorry, Diana, it hasn't quite worked on that sequence. It's a good try, good try. You know, we'll sort of look towards that, keep it in the background. As we talk about the first topic for Cultural Connections today, which indeed addresses the whole aspect of the STEM agenda. Now, as a science graduate initially, I've got a certain sympathy with respect to this, but I can appreciate that there are a lot of questions in terms of what we see with science, technology, engineering and mathematics in the current world. I've talked about this in a symbiotic manner, and hopefully you appreciate, Abigail, I'm saying, how can we work together with respect to the sciences as opposed to seeing them as the enemy? Because sometimes we get a connection between the humanities and the arts, and we don't do that, etc. From your own perspective, is this something which you're conscious of in your role as head of the College of Arts, that actually there's always that background of what are the scientists doing now?
Well, I suppose, you know, people probably heard about from STEM to STEAM, which is how do we put the arts into STEM?
Yeah.
Because, you know, we're all better together. And, you know, I began my lecturing career at Imperial College London, which is a science university.
Hard science, including hard actually science. Having a utilitarian philosopher's skeleton in the actual routine, I believe.
That's UCL.
Oh, UCL, there
just
we are.
Just up the road.
Thank you.
At Imperial, I was one of a very small group of historians and other people whose job was to humanise the scientists. And it was compulsory for all the scientists to do a history or a politics or a sort of languages course. And a lot of them hated it. They absolutely hated it. But, you know, I quite liked it. I got medical students to talk to history of medicine about. And, over the course of 5-6 years, it really developed into a wonderful course where everyone got so much out of it. And I hope they went on to be better doctors. I hope I went on to be a better lecturer. And then I moved to King's College London, where I was teaching history students who were terrified of science. Mm-hmm. You'd put a course on the module books, which would be, and if you had science in the title, they'd run a mile. If you called it knowledge or belief, that was okay. They liked that. You sort of snuck it in by the back door, and eventually through experience, people realised that actually this was really quite interesting, and that you couldn't really understand the world as a scientist without knowing something about the arts, and you couldn't really understand the world as an artist without knowing something about science.
The notion of the Renaissance scholar, which probably was best epitomised by Jonathan Powell when he actually did the history of medicine and focused with respect to that whole side of things. And then you get obviously people like Carl Sagan and other areas who are popularisers of science and working through that. We seem to be talking about this relationship, as you said, stem to steam, the arts and science, for quite some time, and there has always been that interesting division, analogous, one might say, to the whole notion of F.R. Leavis and his canon of perfect texts in literature. Actually, there's these things you should study, and you shouldn't be doing lectures on C.S. Lewis and Narnia, because that's just trivial, and so on. Is there a kind of echo of that? That somehow we like to compartmentalise things and work on that sort of premise, that we like to quantify the qualitative?
Well, people have been trying to do interdisciplinarity for a very, very, very long time. They've been proclaiming it as the next new thing for decades. And so you have to ask where all that effort went and what's come out the pipe, and that we're still proclaiming it something new. Seeing it as something important, but we haven't quite managed it yet. So, yeah, silos are powerful things. They're hard to...
Let's bring in Amy on this particular one then. I mean, have we been talking about this from way back in medieval times, that actually we need to work together, we have the whole person? Is it true that really it's Francis Bacon and Erasmus, they're the last people who could actually be genuinely interdisciplinary in terms of their studies?
I'm not sure I would go that far, because I would hope that there are people since Erasmus and Bacon that are truly interdisciplinary. But I do think, and I have to say, I was sort of struck by the term Renaissance, I would say medieval, just in terms of when you think about where science sat in the Middle Ages, it was very much part of liberal arts and connected to things like theology and philosophy. So if you want to talk about interdisciplinarity, it really goes back to 12th century France, where they started this whole educational system based on the liberal arts. So I think that, like Abigail said, interdisciplinarity has been the next new thing for some time. I do think there have been changes just in terms of how we create those bridges. So now there's obviously an emphasis on technology and things like digital humanities and digital resources, digital literacy, digital heritage, all of these things. So I think that I'm hoping that as we go forward, we can be a little more true to that nice medieval liberal arts model of working with people across the college, but also across the university.
I mean, is there a sense as well that we often look at what I refer to as the pre-Copernican era and the post-Copernican era, that 1485 was when it all started to go wrong or right?
Again, 1485, it's an American, I think I'd probably say 1492, when Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Mm-hmm. I would actually put it up a little bit earlier than 1485, true to my medieval roots.
I was just thinking of Nicholas Copernicus, well-known Polish astronomer, which brings us neatly round to Romania, because it's not too far away from Poland. You see what I did there? And in terms of that, Dina, is this something in architecture? Because you could say architecture is a true synthesis of both the art of the vision of the building and so on, and the fact that if you don't build it on scientific methods and rubrics, the whole thing will collapse.
Yes, I think that all architects would go back to the definition of architecture given by Vitruvius, that a building needs to have utilitas, firmitas, venustas. So it has to be useful, it has to be firm, robust, and beautiful. And there you have exactly what you said, you know, the confluence of art and science. And it has been like that for millennia, I would say. It's only in recent years, I think that this is what's interesting, that it's the reverse that's happening in architecture, that now there are courses which where people specialize. So they are more specialized in things like I did at university, like landscape architecture, like we did philosophy and philosophy of art, we did the history of art and history of architecture. Now these are separate
disciplines.
Yeah. And I think that is good. But also I would say that making our students aware that this is a panoply of knowledge, they need to have awareness of, if not ultimate control. In some areas they need to have control, because architecture is a profession and there are consequences for not doing it right. I think that having awareness gives them the ability to stay nimble, to adapt and do different things. So in my career, I was at some point a graphic designer, I was an interior designer, I was able to move quite easily.
So there we have it, Abigail. All you need is to bring in the architects and problem solved. You won't have students scared to go off in different directions. You just need to work on the building metaphor and then the structure will be in place there. Talking about building, let's talk about B-52s. This is your choice, Amy, in terms of B-52s. Not Love Shack, but something to do with roaming. So
yes.
Share with us why this choice.
Well, here I am, a Midwestern person from the middle of, you know, the United States, living in Lincoln. And of course, this song has to do with roaming around the world. Roam if you want to, roam around the world. And I have been very lucky in my ability to roam throughout the world with my family individually. And as I think of my own family, I have one son who lived in Thailand, and the other one is currently living in Jordan. And here I am in Lincoln. So we clearly like to roam quite a bit as a family.
listening to Siren Radio and its Cultural Connections with Professor Amy Livingston, with Professor Abigail Woods, and Dino Carter. So, all great stuff there. And that was the B52s. Can hardly get the words out today. Let's talk broadcasting, public service broadcasting in particular. If we can come to you first on this one, Amy, because NPR Radio, National Public Radio, and of course Campus Radio, in many ways served as one of the influences behind setting up Siren Radio. I mean, when we came up with the idea in 1997 now, that whole notion of scholars in radio entertainment was looking at the best of experiences with Cambridge University Radio, also the establishment, obviously, within the global sense of Campus Radio, etc. Do you feel that when you're in Britain, somehow you miss out on public service broadcasting because the BBC just doesn't know where it is these days?
Well, I will say it's very different than what I'm used to from NPR in the United States. I was an avid NPR listener wherever we lived, in Indiana, Ohio, Michigan, Tennessee. And it was nice because wherever you went, you always had usually had a pretty good NPR station. And the thing that I liked about it was that there really was this nice combination of global, national, but also local interest, which was great if you were particularly moving to a new area and trying to figure out, you know, what was up. So I do listen to the BBC, but I will say that I do miss NPR, and occasionally I stream my local NPR station just to find out what's going on in the depths of Indiana.
Well, we'd like to feel that Siren Radio can be streaming in some parts in Indiana as well, even as we speak. So,
well, yeah, when I'm back there next month, I'll be sure to stream Siren Radio.
Exactly. Dinah, from your own perspective in Romania, clearly you've had a shift culturally substantially and dramatically. I mean, I've even spoken to students who are saying that, you know, the legacy of Ceausescu is still there in terms of, obviously, the responses and so on. But in terms of broadcasting, do you feel as though we're in a healthy state in Britain? Do you feel as though there is a plurality of things? I mean, we have within Siren Radio, as we talked to Abigail in a few moments, a cultural asset. I mean, is it something which you say that's a significant aspect of our whole culture, really, that we need it?
Well, it's an interesting question, and when I saw it as one of the subjects for today, I had to question myself, is this about just Britain, or what happens somewhere else as well? Because one of the things everybody learns when they're about to set up a revolution is that they have to get to the TV station and radio station as soon as possible, because that's how they'll influence public opinion and actually what happens from there on. And for me, watching the Romanian Revolution unfold basically on TV and over the radio was something unexpected and something one can't forget. So, yes, you were talking earlier about communication and the ability to hold the attention of a whole country who is not aware of what's happening, really, and give information exactly as wanted and needed, proved a very powerful tool. So comparing it with what happens here, there is no comparison. But what I find interesting is how things are financially supported financially, and that's where the pull and push and the pressures might appear. So I was quickly looking at what the research says about public broadcasting, and apparently the perception is that it's losing an audience in terms of number and demographics, but the financial support is still there. So the losing of numbers is not proportional with the financial support.
The interesting thing, of course, is do you actually judge the success of a service on the basis of its numbers? That's critical in terms of where we're looking through the process. And I think you're absolutely right. When we developed the third tier of broadcasting in Britain back in 1990 with the 90 Broadcasting Act, which opened up an opportunity to do what we're doing today, basically, have people who would not normally be part of the mainstream commercial or public service BBC network to have a chance to discuss topics and develop them in a professional and key way. Abigail, I can assure you that Siren Radio is not going to take part in a revolution in the near future, just in case you thought, revolutionary sort of topics will take control of Siren and then the world. Although Ola has had one or thoughts about that, but that's another issue. I use the term that you'd also cite as well, that Siren is seen now as a cultural asset, which is very apt in terms of obviously cultural connections. So from your own perspective, is that something which you think is important? It should be treasured, it should be looked after and you know, developed and allowed to grow, really?
Well, absolutely. And it does come back to this issue about public good, doesn't it? I mean, that's, you know, public service broadcasting is a public good. And, you know, the benefits that Siren brings to not just the university community, but, you know, to the Lincoln community, not just as consumers and listeners, but as producers. Mm. And it goes back to what Dornia was saying about numbers. It's not just the people that tune in to listen. It's that all of the people who get to participate in the making of the programmes, our volunteers from outside of the university, and the chance to engage with, you know, all of these topical issues and to connect with each other. So it's a real, you know, such an important asset for the university.
You managed to do the whole piece without mentioning impact studies once. That was wonderful. I think an award for you just for that alone, for sort of staying away from impact. But you're absolutely right. And I think the notion that if Reith had actually set up the BBC today, he wouldn't have used focus groups. You know, sometimes we can get a bit too caught up in the decisions. I mean, Radio Pacifica is a good model again in the West Coast of how sometimes coping with a hyper-commercialised field can simply be a case of, okay, we look at ways with that around that. A fun fact about Siren, which occasionally we've used, that the budget for Siren launched and built these very studios actually was exactly the same as that was used to launch the BBC in 1922, £60,000. So there we are. So still got way forward, but, you know, just a thought in terms of where we're going. Speaking of where we're going, what about AHA? Morton Hackett, of course. I wouldn't have pegged this as one of your choices, Abigail, but it is. So would you like to share with us why you've gone for Take On Me?
I have gone for Take On Me because it's a song that's been following me around my entire life. It's one of the first songs I remember at the school disco.
A job interview, you know, you actually use it, sort of subtly put together.
Not job interviews, but I was there when it came out in 1984. And interestingly, when I went to Manchester to do my postgrad degree, when I felt very old, I was 26, and I went back to a master's degree, I felt so old. And I went to the retro bar in Manchester called Fab Cafe, which was the first movie film themed bar, and it had a Dalek by the outside, it had the Star Wars, Space Invader machines, and it was retro night after Postgrad Society and they played that.
let's see in a few moments if we can kind of deduce or develop a roadmap for the future of humanities. And let's turn to Doina first and foremost, because clearly, as we mentioned at the start, Doina, you are head of teaching and learning within the School of Architecture. You're clearly concerned and passion for education and so on. Do you feel as though you got it right, or do you think it's a case of we're just exploring this? We've still got a ways to go in terms of accommodating some of the challenges that the humanities are faced with.
Well, I think that I'll refer back to our first topic, which was about STEM. And I think that the world is now faced with so many issues we need to address, like climate change and the ability to build sustainably, which involves a lot of science. And not only the science as an abstract thing, but also as application and quite quick. This process between innovation, development of a product, of technology to application has to happen really fast. Of course, for good reasons, a lot of the industry, the construction industry, has concentrated on that. And sometimes, at least at a perceived level, to the detriment of the humanities. But I don't think that the architecture can be without having the two. So if you ask me, the humanities have to survive for our survival. So I remember when I wrote the first lecture for first year students, I wanted to tell them everything I knew in 1 hour. And of course, I started with Nietzsche. I was referring to his idea that we as humans cannot cope with our humanity, our human condition, without art. That's one of the ways we can do it. And I was trying to explain to the first year students in one of their first lectures the difference between Apollonian and Dionysian.
Might have been a bit ambitious. I possibly would have actually just led with Was man nicht tut, bringt man stärker. You know, what doesn't destroy one makes one stronger, and build from there, perhaps.
Yes. Well, I didn't have that wisdom at that point. Oh. Hopefully, that has grown.
Indeed, Abigail, let's turn to yourself again. You're clearly, part of your role, presumably as head of the College of Arts and Pro Vice Chancellor, is looking at what insanities the government put forward, my words from that point of view, and indeed the rest of the material from that point of view, and trying to square that circle. Do you feel as though, in essence, continuing the metaphor, the glass is half full, that actually we're getting it right, or do we still have to get to the stage of saying, well, maybe we need to de-silo once again?
Well, we are de-siloing. I mean, I think...
In this very programme?
Yes. I mean, you know, I think survival depends on us de-siloing institutionally, socially, politically, and intellectually, you know, because everything is connected. I mean, at the end of every technical problem is a human problem in the end. So if you don't understand the people, then you're not going to get it very far, you know, no matter what you're trying to do.
Does not compute. How often those words sort of echo. It's the equivalent, I suppose, of how you tried turning it off and starting it again, basically, in IT things. But anyway. And Amy, again, something from your own perspective as a medieval specialist from that point of view and working for that, do you feel as though, yeah, we can learn something from history here? You know, it is important. We don't repeat the mistakes.
Well, one hopes we don't repeat the mistakes, although we don't have a very good track record of looking to the past to chart our present. But hopefully we'll get better at that. But I do think that STEM needs humanities and humanities needs STEM. We train students in the humanities to think critically, right, to confront problems, to come up with creative ways of solving those problems, understanding the human condition, being able to articulate different perspectives, to understand, to walk in someone else's shoes. So you have to be able to sort of marry up the humanities with science in order to succeed. And if we're going to solve these huge global issues like climate change, institutional racism, these sorts of things, you're going to need humanists at the heart of that to help guide those conversations.
As we said in the chat before the program. Actually, we're in the midst of World Water Day, and there are citizens in Kenya who have a 9-kilometer walk just to get some fresh water, basically, on a round trip. So again, issues with respect to that. Other strange departmental choices, of course. Plastic Bertrand Simplon Forme pour moi. Not one I seem to recall being a part of the, shall we say, Romania that I was familiar with in any way, shape or form. So why have you gone for this as your next choice, please, Doina?
Well, it's because I created this little series of lectures and seminars, which is about context, and in which I'm trying to explain to students that context doesn't necessarily mean just the physical condition one looks at when designing a building, but context is everything, is society, is people, is exactly what we are talking about. And I wanted to make it really immersive. And for each, there were different case studies, and for each case study I selected two pieces of music which were relevant to that period of time. And Plastic Bertrand was relevant for one of them. And to my absolute joy, some students told me that they added it to their playlist. Success.
So not sure, well, back in 1977 he was viewed as perhaps the saviour he's become considered as these days, but nevertheless, it's your choice. Here he comes. Bam bam, mon sas place, j'ai sur mon lit à bouffer sa langue en buvant trop mon whisky. Quant à moi, peu dormi, vie débris, mais j'ai dû dormir dans la gouttière où j'ai eu un flash. En quatre couleurs. Allez hop, un matin, une louloute est venue chez moi, poupée de cellophane, cheveux chinois, un sparadrap, une gueule de bois, a bu ma bière dans un grand verre en caoutchouc. Comme un indien dans son igloo, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi, 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 ça plane pour moi, ça plane pour moi. Du paillasson, limé, ruiné, vidé, comblé, you are the king of the divan, qu'elle me dit en passant. Sudden synchronicity in actually moving from Plastic Bertrand to finding out the quirky experiences people have actually had since joining the University of Lincoln. Abigail, I'll come to you first because you joined height of the pandemic and you thought, this is wonderful. I can connect with people via this sort of strange device called a computer and so on. It's high tech. But apart from that, how have your experiences been? Have you actually encountered anything which has been unusual, charming, quite frankly, incomprehensible? You can talk about one uni if you wish, but that's it.
I'm going to go with the charming Lincoln longwool sheep, which is an endangered breed. Yeah, so you don't typically see them outside of the county. We've got a lovely little flock up at Rise Home, and they are the sheep on whose back Lincolnshire was built. So historically, they're fascinating. They're just lovely to look at. You know, they're heritage in and of themselves. They need preserving.
Each year, when we cover for Zion Radio the Lincolnshire Show, the Long Wool Sheep very much part of the whole sort of experience that's actually there. And we often come up with that maxim that a farmer who shears his sheep in May loves his wool more than he loves his sheep. Interesting line. Excellent. Good choice. Dinah, what about yourself in terms of bizarre experiences or thing? I mean, presumably, you know, whether it's Budapest or, well, it's Hungary, but whether it's Romania, any of those systems, it could be just Lincoln by another name. We've got the castle, we've got Transylvania, or are there any strange other things that have occurred since joining the university?
Yes, I don't think that I have identified any Dracula, references in Lincoln.
Whitby is a bit further north, you see. Yeah. I mean,
that's a different routine there. Yeah, that's true. Well, what I always appreciated in Lincoln is how it made my life easy as an educator, because I was able to contextualize what I was talking about. Especially, we were talking about humanities and history and how this can be a difficult subject for students, and sometimes they ask, why do I have to learn about these old buildings? And also not having any palpable evidence, just looking at slides makes it more difficult, but not Lincoln. So we have Roman remains, we have Romanesque architecture. It's an amazing laboratory for our teaching and our students' learning. And very good, and that's exceptional, I think, modern architecture, award-winning.
Moving to Amy, I think we'll hold your experiences until after we've heard your penultimate track today, which is Jimmy Buffett and Cheeseburger in Paradise, something which has been mentioned to me various times. It seems to be cycled every sort of few years, somebody mentions. What about Cheeseburger in Paradise? And today you brought it to us. Would you like to explain why?
Sure. So going back to my well-spent youth again, my husband and I were diehard Jimmy Buffett fans when we were at uni together. And this is a passion we have passed on to our children. And so whenever we would go on beach vacations in particular, we would pack up our van, as Americans do, and head out to the Outer Banks of North Carolina, which was about a 14-hour drive. Or when we went to the Caribbean, we always listened to Jimmy Buffett. And I will say, I have been missing a cheeseburger since you ask me the sort of things about being over here. And no offense, but as a farm girl from the Midwest, where our cows are a little bit fatter and fattier, I'm missing the American cheeseburger.
It's the fat that gives taste.
That's the key thing. So I'm missing my cheeseburger in paradise.
Cheeseburger in paradise.
Really, we need to give an apology for any vegan listeners who might be sort of slightly concerned about that. But Cheeseburger in Paradise, it's there. It was indeed Professor Amy Livingston's choice. So you take full responsibility, Amy, is what I'm saying. Any sort of lines that come through on that basis. Apart from, obviously, the lack of decent cheeseburgers, and, of course, we don't want to get into franchise discourses and debates at this particular aspect. Anything else that you found peculiar or unusual about the British approach in Lincoln? Or is it a case of, frankly, where do I start?
No, I've had a few moments of sort of puzzlement over things. You know, the fact that I don't have an electrical outlet in my bathroom. But, you know, things are slightly different. The thing that was the most challenging coming here at the uni was this unbelievable alphabet soup of acronyms, which I still struggle with daily.
We change the name of the buildings usually on every sort of 18-month rolling.
Well, I appreciate that warning. So I will update my two pages of spreadsheet with the different, you know, acronyms. So that's been a bit of a challenge. But one of the things that I found most endearing and most wonderful about being here is the graduation ceremonies in the cathedral. You know, as a medieval historian, wearing a robe, walking into anywhere from a 12th to a 15th century building, it was profoundly moving for me, but also I could see for the students and the community. And I just think that's a really special part of being here at Lincoln, is that moment.
And no truth in the rumor, Abigail, that you've put in a bid to actually replace the theme Jerusalem with Aha and Take On Me.
No truth at
no,
all.
No, just want to clarify that's there, because sometimes, you know, we just want to ensure that's sort of. Doña, return to your final choice of music, which you wanted to leave until the end. It's Pueblo Cafe. Would you like to, again, explain why you've chosen this one?
I've chosen this one because what I've always appreciated in working at the university is the ability to interact with the young minds, and watching them arrive and be so different. And I think that if you work in academia for a long time, you start seeing trends and changes in behavior.
You're suggesting we see the same cycles coming around in different yes, it's a short answer.
Possibly, but no, we just realize that we need to continuously adapt as well. And keep up, actually listen to them. And this piece of music came from a suggestion from my children about what to watch to keep up with the times. So it comes from the Silicon Valley series.
Quite literally, Nuevos Tiempos, new times.
Exactly.
Café aquí para la gente, revolución mundial de repente. Más venenoso que una serpiente. Rico, cínico y pueblo café, trayendo talento, así debe de ser. Nada de envidiosos como la vez. El tiempo nos pasa como un tren.
Son nuevos tiempos aquí.
La vida está llena de reflejos. Diario me miro en el espejo. Digo yo mismo, tenemos que subir para la buena vida poder vivir. Nunca más quiero yo sufrir. Que los tiempos malos me hagan reír. No hay tiempo de mentiras. No más liquidando y andando en gira. Yo nunca ignoro los consejos. Mi jefa me da para no ser pendejo. Vamos a salir adelante con sacrificio iluminante. Contando cuentos desde más antes. Esta vida es lo más radiante.
Son nuevos tiempos aquí.
One more time.
Son nuevos tiempos aquí. Pero no puedo olvidar yo.
Classic case of cultural hybridization, one might say, Joanna. Excellent choice. Marvellous. Well, we've put to rights the STEM agenda. We've moved from STEM to STEAM, quite rightly so. We talked about public service broadcasting. That's been put right as well. So I feel in the last 3,600 seconds or thereabouts, we've addressed a number of key issues. Abigail, any closing thoughts you'd like to share with us? That was wonderful. It was telepathy in action there. I thought that was so profound. It was just, it's all we need is to actually work through that. It's the best thing ever. Superb stuff there. We've got a perfect tune to actually see us out with, of course. It's What a Wonderful World by Louis Armstrong. Is that something, I mean, you mentioned, Amy, that you've got, obviously, your children in different countries and so on. I won't say proud, because pride comes before fall, so, but I think we're very pleased and delighted with the way in which diversity is very much embedded in terms of the University of Lincoln and in terms of the philosophy that actually is part and parcel of that whole system. Was that part of the thinking behind this, or was it just a case of, it's Louis Armstrong, what else can I say?
Well, there is that, but I will say I tend to be an optimist and like to think of it as a wonderful world, but I also thought, given cultural connections, the idea of world, and it really is a wonderful world. We have challenges. It's been interesting roaming around it, as I've been able to do, and I hope I would encourage our students out there to do the same, because travel is a life-changing experience, and encountering the world in different places can really shape your perspective and help you grow as a person. So for that reason, and it also has a whole host of nostalgic memories having to do with my father and my children. So I'll just leave it at that. But it's a wonderful world.
And Dinah, say we started off with obviously discussions of Romania, Transylvania, and so on. I mean, Romania is opening up a whole new range of things now. But I'm going to ask you, because Ola did raise this earlier, and as executive producer, he needs to address this. Would you like to say a greeting in Romanian to any Romanian listeners or Romanian speakers who might be out there? Sort of a greeting from the School of Architecture, perhaps.
Salve.
Fantastic. That's it. Exactly. I was just going to say, truly Roman in every sense of the word. Dinah Carter, Professor Amy Livingston, Professor Abigail Woods, huge thanks. Thank you for taking part in Cultural Connections. Cultural Collections. You see, I'm thinking of the historical side of things there. Let's go out with Louis Armstrong. What a Wonderful World.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue, clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night, and I think to myself,
what a wonderful world. The colors of the rainbow, so pretty in the sky, are also on the faces of people going by. I see friends shaking hands, saying, how do you do? They're really saying, I love you. I hear babies cry, I watch them grow. They're like much more than I ever knew. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.